today. We're convening Tuesday, April 17th, 2007, for the purpose of a public hearing, continuing on Senate Bill 5518, the budget of the Oregon Judicial Department. Before we get started, Robin, do you have anything you want to
A couple of things. Well, just a reminder, today we're going to be talking primarily about the policy option packages. Also, there's a handout that goes under Section 8 of your overview. I want to call it a manual. Anyway, that binder. It's been a long day.
The one with the orange cover?
Yeah. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Robin. So at this time, why don't we bring up Ms. Click and Ms. Gates, and we'll continue with the budget overview and drivers and essential budget level.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator, and we're going to spend about 10 or 15 minutes just to touch on the budget drivers and the essential budget level, and then we'll proceed into the policy option packages. In your binders with the orange cover, we're starting at page 63. There's a page called Prioritization of Programs and Services. And as you heard yesterday a little bit more about the Judicial Department and the vision and the performance measures and how our overall department uses strategic planning, this prioritization also plays in that arena, both when we're looking at what we need to do with limited resources or also when we were in the situation of having to actually cut resources and cut services. We use this list that was worked out with the trial courts and the appellate courts and staff. On the left side, it talks about the principles and values that we use to evaluate court program service priorities, and those include putting public safety and personal safety crimes first, along with children and families, most vulnerable of our case types. On the right-hand side is our rough prioritization. As you know, we have no way to really eliminate or stop doing any case type that's provided by statute or constitution. But when we've been faced with where to put our resources first, we've used these guidelines as what needs to be taken care of in response to timelines and public safety and vulnerable case priorities. So as far as budget drivers, on page 69 and 70-71, we talk about that a little bit. On page 69, you've seen this probably graph in a couple of different scenarios, but it does illustrate fairly simply that everything comes through our doors in the courts, and also how courts are this backbone in the community for the children and family issues, the quality of life, and economy in Oregon. Everything comes through our doors in the sense that the courts are a reactive branch of government, in that someone else has to initiate the case or the matter and bring it to the court. It's not something that courts can go out and drum up business, so to speak. So everything comes to us, how it comes to us, how much of it comes to us, the type of matter that comes to us is very much defined by the entities outside, such as law enforcement, district attorneys, the public, social needs, treatment services. All those can affect what type of case we receive, the complexity, how it's handled, the timing of getting it through. So you will hear more about in saying that the courts are a reactive branch of government, in that we don't control what comes to us. We try to be very proactive once we have it and come up with innovative and workable procedures and processes to handle the cases before us for better outcomes. And you'll hear in the policy option packages discussion just how the courts are doing that. Page 70 just is a little picture of when you say things get more complex, just an illustration of how that happens. Like pre-95, you have your more straightforward arrests, prosecutions, filings, ballot measures, constitutional mandates. And then in 95 through 2003, we had the Adoption and Safe Families Act. That was a federal initiative that put very strict timelines on the states in handling permanency planning for children. We had Measure 11. Then you get after 2003, and you have much more emphasis in the burgeoning drug and property crime area with methamphetamines. You have a large increasing self-representation population and domestic relations. So it's just a way of illustrating. We have some other materials in our responses to the committee where we're providing what did it look like then, what does it look like now. You heard Judge Bearden speak the other day about a case may look like a case statistically, but this is the difference in the type of case I had in my juvenile court 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and then here's what I have now. That's illustrated on page 71, just a little bit about what are the major environmental factors that influence what comes into the court. You have legal changes, of course, every session. We have a large number of bills that require interpretation or application in the courts. They range from new crimes to new civil remedies. You have workload drivers that we've talked about in the last couple of days, and having to do with not only the case mix, but also just the technological tools we have to manage those increasing caseloads. Talked about in some of the testimony already, the economic and demographic factors, things going on with adults and juveniles, the state's economy and employment, the change in the population, both the needs for greater linguistic services as well as just substance abuse programs to respond to what's happening in our systems, our social systems. You also have the criminal justice partner activity. You all are very aware of how everything in our processes are part of a larger system. And so the levels of staffing or lack of staffing in law enforcement, in DAs, in jail space, in probation, in treatment programs, and other service programs greatly affect not only what we're handling and the speed they go through, but also what your options are. So it's very important in our budget and in our request, we think, to make sure that the court system is not just treading water, but that it's really a strong and viable backbone for this maintaining the balance in the system. Because nothing gets from A to Z without going through the court and the system. So
could I ask you a question?
Sure.
And perhaps this might be for Judge Block or for Judge Dominguez or for someone else during the course, and I don't necessarily need an answer now, but one thing that I've heard is that with Measure 11, with mandatory sentencing, there's less discretion on the part of judges, and so I've heard it suggested that the workload on Measure 11 cases would be less than, say, the workload on cases from the old days. Is that just a myth, or do you think there's any validity to that?
Chair Shields, it's not a myth. It was a difference. And the judges can answer in more the judicial discretion area, but what we saw was there was a workload impact. It had, because of the severity and changes to the disposition of the cases, there's more motions practice, more other things that happened within the cases themselves. But on the other hand, there were some overall increases are hard to document because then the district attorneys also adjusted. Measure 11 charging was used somewhat as a plea negotiation item, as well as they could only, if they concentrated on those, then they did let go of some other case types that they might have prosecuted. So Measure 11 did have an impact. The question was what the system adjusts in a certain way, and then what if you took it away or you did something different, there would, you know, the cause and effect isn't quite as straightforward as when you put it in. Is that enough of a response?
I think so. Perhaps I'll ask the same question of Judge Block. get his experience working in the trenches day after day. Next.
We're going to turn now to just a brief explanation of the essential budget level, and that Sarah Gates will take you through, and then we'll go over to the policy.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Sarah Gates, Deputy State Court Administrator, and this wouldn't be a budget hearing if we didn't go through essential budget level and talk about funding, what's general fund and other funds and federal funds, so let's do it. Page 75. The graph you see there is just a quick representation of how our budget compares from the current biennia into 07-09, and this is general fund only. The $282 million is including the supplemental appropriation that we have received for the interpreters that is just going through the process right now. So the numbers you've seen from Robin is 280.4. It's the same budget, just including the supplemental. The essential budget level we've run you through before in prior hearings, it's $311.9 million, and then the entire Chief Justice's recommended budget is $373.3. Our essential budget level is a 10.5% increase from our current general fund budget. The next page is a repetition of graphs you've seen earlier in the presentations that just breaks out our entire total funds budget for next biennium by program area. And page 77 does the same thing, except it's by funding type. And no surprise, we are predominantly generally funded. The graph on page 77 is the essential budget level, or maintenance level, as we prefer to call it. So you'll see the $311.9 million general fund is once again. We do have a small proportion of other funds and federal funds, and we talked a little bit about those revenues yesterday, and I'll touch on them again on the next page.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative. Which one?
Hannah. thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we just switch titles? Is that what we did? We went from essential budget to maintenance level? But is that the same number?
Representative Hannah, Chair Shields, we use them interchangeably, yes.
It's the same thing. It's just that this one. Follow up. On 75, on page 75, what you show at 311.9 is the general fund only essential budget level. That same 311 is part of the 348.5 total funds, which we are now calling maintenance level. Those two terms are interchangeable.
Representative Hannah, Chair Shields, that is absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Moving on to page 78 is the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget or essential budget level shown by program area and funding source. And this graph is just to point out to you that our other funds revenue is distributed throughout our various program areas. It is predominantly in the administration area and in the circuit courts, and that's related to collections activities, our application and contribution program, and other forms of other funds revenues that we collect centrally, such as OGIN online revenues. The chart on page 79 is designed to be illustrative of the disinvestment in the Judicial Department's budget over the last three biennia. The top line shows what our budget would be today if the budget in 2001-03 had been maintained without the cuts that happened because of the recession. The top line starts with the original 2001-03 legislatively approved budget, and it grows only by what the standard inflation that was granted to agencies and the personal services roll up. So that's, if we had been just given our essential budget level year after biennia after biennia, that's what we would have today for a budget. The bottom line.
Please, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, what is that standard rate of inflation that's been granted? Do you know?
Representative Cameron, Representative Shields, it varies from year to year. DAS Budget and Management sets it. It's based on the Portland Consumer Price Index, and it's usually in the 2-3% per biennia.
Hey, Mr. Chair, maybe that would be, if we looked at from the 01 biennium to what we're recommending, what that percentage is over those bienniums, that'd be good information to know if that's a standard application.
What the actual
percentages, even if it's broke down by biennium, what DAS is used for that.
Representative Cameron, Representative Shields, what that line reflects is both the standard services and supplies inflation, which is the 2-3%, and I'll get you that exact number each biennium, but it also reflects how much personal services roll up every biennium. As you know, salaries roll up based on step increases or granted cost of living, and we looked at the actual growth in personal services inflation and applied that. But I will provide those exact numbers to Robin, so any of you who are interested in that can look at it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I don't have the data, so I probably shouldn't bring this up, but there was a standard rate of inflation that agencies were allowed to use in the development of their budget, but agencies did not across the board get that standard level of inflation. As a matter of fact, we made reductions to agency budgets that over this period of time that stripped the executive branch agencies mm-hmm. that stripped that inflationary adjustment out. So all agencies would be showing somewhat of a similar kind of gap at this point because of the budget shortfalls that we had.
Sheriff Shields, and that just was coming up with the next point I wanted to make, which was the bottom line shows what happened to our budget in 0103, and we're not alone in what happened to state agency budgets. The Judicial Department, along with all sorts of other agencies, are facing the same problem, which is the cuts that were done in 0103 have not been restored. And so what this graph is merely to show to you is that the bottom line shows where our budget actually is. The top line shows what it would have been if we'd had healthier economic times and we were allowed to continue at the funding level we were providing the services that we were providing in 0103. The rightmost column, which is 2007-09, shows how the co-chair's budget, our essential budget level, the governor's budget, and the Chief Justice's recommended budget stacks up with that funding level that we had back in 0103. And it just shows that we're just making progress towards regaining on the disinvestment in our budget. It's a way to help you understand how far we have to climb back to go back to that level of funding. And we're not unique. That we're not trying to claim that. You're facing it in many, many different agencies.
Ms. Gates, do you have off the top of your head, or could you get it to us, what the legislatively approved budget was for 99-01 and 97-99?
Chair Shields, I don't have that off the top of my head. This is where I get to claim the one-year exemption. I've only been here a year, so I haven't memorized that far back, but I will have it to you tomorrow.
Right, if you could just...
Absolutely. No problem.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions on that page before I move on? Because we're going to start moving into a little more technical budget details at this point. Okay. What I want to give you now is just a sort of an explanation of how we're going to walk through the policy packages and our essential budget level packages. Each time we talk about a package, I'm going to give you the original Chief Justice's recommended budget numbers, which we put into the system last August. And as I'm sure you've seen in every other agency, there have been changes. Things, ballot measures don't pass, you don't need certain positions, you're able to fund things internally, environmental changes. So I'm going to start with the original numbers, which you've all seen before, then I'm going to talk about the adjustments that we're requesting and why. So we're just going to go through that process with each package whenever there's an adjustment. If you'll turn to pages 80 and 81, I want to talk to you about one component of our essential budget level. As you know from other agencies that have been before you, the essential budget level basically is what do you need in order to provide the services you do today, but what does it cost next biennium? That includes your base budget, the roll-up of any things that were started in the prior biennium, price adjustments for inflation. It also includes something called mandated caseload. We have included for the first time a mandated caseload package in the Oregon Judicial Department's budget. In the DAS budget instructions, they recognize that in the criminal justice area, there are mandated caseloads, Department of Corrections, prison inmates, youth authority, the Department of Justice. They also, for the first time, acknowledge that Oregon Judicial Department has mandated caseloads. That is, there are things we have to do. We have no choice. They're required by statute or by constitution. What we have done is taken that direction and used our workload assessment model that we've used for many, many years to tell you how many people are needed to do certain things. If you have a case of X type, you need this many people to process it because it takes this much time. We've looked at what our caseloads are today, how many staff we have today, and calculated the difference and included that as a mandated caseload package. There are four components to this package. The circuit courts need 57 positions to adequately process the cases they have today. That means dealing with them in a timely manner. And as you've heard from when the judge was speaking on prior days, you know, we have a lot more complex cases. Our systems are blocked up, you know, and we're just going to continue to have the log jams if we don't have the staff to adequately process them.
Just a moment, Senator Winters.
When you did your analysis to determine caseload allocations, did you do time on task studies?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, that is based on a workload assessment that was done by the National Center for State Courts, and it's based on how much time it takes to do each type of case. And we have that for judges as well as court staff.
And the National did a time on task?
They did. That's correct.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, before we get too far down this this discussion, I believe the committee needs to understand that there is a difference between what the co-chairs have acknowledged as mandated caseload for the Judicial Department and what the Judicial Department is requesting. And the co-chairs have not acknowledged the workload study as being a legitimate mandated caseload adjustment because the criteria in the Department of Administrative Services budget instructions refers to caseload growth, not workload, and is very specific to that effect. There's a need to take a look at this issue. I think when we get to work session, there will be a recommendation for a budget note that looks at this issue comprehensively across public safety agencies that have interrelated performance measures. But you need to understand that at this point, the co-chairs have removed this adjustment that that Sarah Gates is talking about from the mandated caseload for the court. So when you see my numbers, they will be different from what you are seeing here.
And I think before I let Ms. Gates respond, and I don't want us to get into a big debate on this,
right,
but I think one of the issues that we as a committee are going to have to decide is, you know, where is kind of that essential budget level. And so that's part of the task that we will have as we go closer to work session. And I think it's just important that as you look at page 79, when you see the essential budget level and the co-chairs being under that, part of that is the discrepancy.
And I also wanted to point out, this is not a disagreement over the need for resources. It is a technical discussion about how that need for resources is brought forward. And the co-chairs have indicated that it should be coming forward as a policy option package, not as an automatic budget roll-up, which is what you see in the package 040.
And we will be the jury.
But the question that I asked then becomes very valid because there is a distinct difference between caseload and workload, and the time on task analysis is different. So.
And I think that's a big part of the disagreement. Is that correct, Robin?
That is correct. Yes. That it is, it, like I said, it's not an issue about whether or not there is a need for resources to handle the workload within the courts. The issue is what the definition of mandated caseload is and how that is calculated under the instructions that everyone is following.
And Ms. Gates, you said this is the first time where you've used this process, and I think, you know, that's part of why we're going to have to pay very close attention when we decide the proper budget level for this department. Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I guess I want to clarify then that you're not disputing, LFO's not disputing, the co-chairs aren't disputing, well, maybe the co-chairs are, but LFO is not disputing that they need the dollars in order to meet the need. It's how it's described and how it's treated in the future?
That's Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, that's partially correct.
Okay.
It is a technical discussion about how the budget is built.
Okay.
And then that would then lead to a discussion about what level of resources are needed.
Okay.
The thing about the mandated caseload adjustment that you will see in Public Defense Services, in Department of Justice, is that that comes forward as an automatic roll-up, and then the legislature has to come in and make adjustments to it if they don't believe the caseload is going to materialize, whereas workload is a policy or a budgetary discussion that you would be having as part of the development of the budget, and that is solely where the disagreement is.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Shields, and we are very aware of just the differing opinion. We've had many discussions on it, and we're welcoming this discussion here at the committee. We'd like that policy decision made. There are three other little pieces to this package, since we're cruising through it here. We have a need for four positions in the Citizens Review Board to meet the workload for the juvenile dependency out-of-home placements reviewed by the Citizens Review Board. Right now, the people, all they can do is take time to look, do the physical review of the documents, but they need to be working the system to eliminate the log jams to getting those kids back out of foster care, and we want the positions in order to do that function appropriately. In the Court of Appeals, we also have three positions to support our Court of Appeals. This is one of the busiest courts in the nation. And then finally, we had 10 positions in this package associated, and you'll see on page 81, you'll see removing funding for Ballot Measure 40. We had included 10 positions in response to Ballot Measure 40. That ballot measure did not pass. We do not need those positions or the dollars associated. So out of this packet,
refresh the committee's
this
memory.
Had to do with having the Court of Appeals judges elected by district and having residency requirements, and so there would have been multiple offices and different staffing levels and quite a dramatic impact to the way the court operated. So that's what's in the package that I just described, the 040 package. We are asking for some adjustments to the essential budget level on page 81. You'll see that the first is the Ballot Measure 40 funding, which I just talked about. The second is an increase in the interpreter cost, the expenditures for interpreters, which I talked about yesterday briefly. The demand is growing and growing. It's higher than we anticipated when we built this budget 9 months ago, and so we are requesting that we have a higher level of expenditure authority for that line item. And that completes the essential budget level, and we're going to move into the policy option packages, which start on page 83. The first slide you have there is just an overview of our budget. It shows you the Chief Justice's recommended budget and all of the policy option packages that you'll be hearing about. And these are the original budget numbers. The first package up is judicial compensation, and with that I will turn it over to Kingsley and Chief Demunis.
Chair? While they're coming up, and to is package Ms. Lamont, is package 040 part of the essential budget level, and the other policy packages are part of the Chief Justice's level budget?
That's correct. The 040 package is part of what is normally called the essential budget level.
Okay.
And then the policy packages are added on after that.
Thank you.
Your Honor, welcome back to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm tempted to say for the record, my name is Paul Demunis. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. If I could digress for one moment, as a young lawyer, I once stood up at the end of the state's case in front of Judge Blensley, who was a district court judge in McMinnville, probably my third or fourth trial, and said, "Well, Your Honor, for the record, I move for a judgment of acquittal." The judge said, "Well, for the record, it's granted. Now, could you come in and see me in my chambers?" Don't ever say that again. So every time I say for the record, I think about that lesson I learned. So thank you again for the courtesy you have extended to the Office of Chief Justice and to me personally throughout this session. My remarks this afternoon will be brief. The public has heard my voice in 90 public appearances throughout the state last year on the necessity of adequately funding the judicial branch of government in order to restore it to its co-equal constitutional status and the importance of the role that judicial compensation plays in that effort. In addition, each of you have courteously listened to my voice on this subject. And I'm sure that each of you have heard the voices of community leaders, business leaders, and editorial writers throughout the state and the country, including an editorial in the Wall Street Journal by Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve System, explaining the importance of judicial compensation to the preservation of a strong, accountable, impartial, and innovative court system. All of the numbers that you need to understand this critical issue have been provided to you. My remarks to you this afternoon are not about the numbers. They are instead about the essential governmental role that courts and judges perform in this state. This afternoon, in courtrooms in every part of this state, judges are carrying out the will of the legislative branch of government by implementing and enforcing the laws that you have enacted. This afternoon, judges in this state are adjudicating matters that go to the very foundation of our society. For example, this afternoon, judges are determining whether a broken family can be saved or reunited, or whether, in order to protect a child from evils that many of us simply cannot comprehend, the tie between a parent and a child must be severed for eternity. It is the legislature's laws regarding criminal conduct that judges are carrying out every day when they seek to enforce and implement within the discretionary framework permitted the judicial branch, the sensitive mix of punitive sanctions and reformative programs that will best protect our communities, restore victims, and at the same time reform and heal the individual offender so that they may have the best chance of reclaiming a law-abiding place in the community. It is the legislature's laws and policies that judges carry out when, in a public courtroom, they must, even despite their own personal views, carry out a jury's verdict in order that a person be put to death. It is the legislature's laws and policies that judges are implementing and enforcing when they determine the constitutionality of PERS reform, a $15 billion question, when they protect individuals from dangerous products, and when they protect the most vulnerable in our society from those who prey upon their economic well-being. The responsibility for the safety, well-being, and economic prosperity of individuals and communities in this state that you have assigned and entrusted to judges in this state is monumental. It is a responsibility that every judge in this state treats with the utmost respect, the utmost seriousness, and the utmost humility. The complex and finite calculations about human behavior that you require judges to make every day requires that those judges be individuals of integrity, intelligence, wisdom, creativity, and innovation. Our children and our grandchildren, yours and mine, and the communities that they will live in, deserve judges that possess those same traits, character, and abilities that I have described. Indeed, in a large measure, our state's continued well-being and economic prosperity depend on it. Setting judicial compensation at a level that is commensurate with the serious and often grave responsibilities placed on judges in this state is not a matter of judicial or personal self-interest. Instead, it's a responsibility that our Constitution places on you to preserve for our children and our grandchildren a judicial system that will remain strong, accountable, innovative, and that will continue to attract some of the best and brightest minds in the legal profession to a career in judicial service. In other words, this is not about me. It's about those who will come after me. Just as you have an obligation to promote other essentials to community well-being and economic growth, such as good schools, universities, health care, public safety, so also do you have an obligation to fund the judicial branch at a level that permits it to meet the challenges of today and the future. Adequate judicial compensation is not only a matter of fairness. It's a core component of the bedrock principle of treating the judiciary as a co-equal and independent branch of government. The future of the judicial branch as a strong, respected, and independent branch of government rests in large measure upon a fair system of compensation for those lawyers who leave the practice of law for judicial service. Only your branch of government can assure that that is the future. Failure to meaningfully address judicial compensation at this legislative session will have the real potential to demoralize this vital, responsive, and innovative branch of government. Moreover, failure to provide reasonable compensation for judges will eventually threaten the competence, efficiency of the judicial system, and ultimately the public's confidence in the court's impartial enforcement of the rule of law. I'd like to end where I began. I thank each and every one of you for the courtesy that you have extended to the Office of Chief Justice and the courtesy you've extended to me personally. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, how would you like to proceed next?
Let me go into some of the other policy option packages. This is our judicial compensation as first and foremost. You heard the reasons why the package numbers were $10 million with the adjustments in two phases and $14 million with them in one. We have other information along those lines. As Chief mentioned, the power of the judicial branch is with the judges.
Can you bring the microphone closer to you?
The power of the judicial branch is with the judges. Without the judges, there is no power within the judicial branch, and it doesn't matter how many staff or anything else that you have. So if you do not fix that part of the system, it isn't good to try and fix anything else because it won't work. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go with our others.
And just for the information of the committee, one of the things that we talked about, if we can't claw back all of the dollars there, we talked in private about a ratio of about $500,000 to increase salary $1,000 per biennium. Is that correct? So $500 a year?
$500,000 a biennium.
For $1,000 over the course of the biennium.
Is it here? Sorry.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Sarah Gates. It would cost $500,000 for every $1,000 increase in salary per year. So if it goes from $100,000 to $1,000 per year, it costs an additional $500,000 for each of those $1,000 increments.
Okay. Per year?
Per year.
Okay.
So $1 million per biennium?
Yeah. No, excuse me, Chair Shields, Representative Senator Westland. For every $1,000, you increase the salary on an annual basis. So we're making $100,000 a year today, or make $100,001 in the future, say, per year. It'll cost you $500,000 a biennium. So the biennial cost of a $1,000 raise is
$500,000.
That's actually $2,500.
Yes, Representative Kimmel. In policy option 101, it talks about that, or wherever it was, I saw that. Oh, yeah, here it is. Judges' salaries have not been increased, and we rank last in the nation. If we were to implement 101 and take them to 125,000, where does that take us ranking in the nation?
This to the Chair Shields and Representative Cameron. It is somewhat a moving target as other salaries in the country are increasing. At the time, it was just slightly above median. Right now, I believe it's at the median. But we do have that chart. It's behind tab 5, which is the older version. And on page 11 behind tab 5, the very last page, shows the rankings then. Right.
Follow up with me.
We'll provide you with the most current one.
Do we have any information, and maybe it's in here, do we have any information about the average attorney's income in the state of Oregon versus the rest of the United States?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, and the Task Force for Judicial Excellence, I believe there is some information there. We also have information from the bar and from our own Human Resources Department that compare with various other positions for attorneys in state government and in private, in local and county, and we can give you more comparative information that you would like. We do have that collected.
It's clicked, I believe. The Chief Justice has wanted to throw in a word to
yes.
Representative Cameron. If you could please come to the microphone.
I just became aware of another study that I think goes directly to your point. There is a study that I just became aware of on attorney compensation in Oregon and throughout the country, and I'd be happy to provide that study to you if that would be helpful.
That would be very good to have.
Yeah. Do you think you could get one for each of us?
Yes. I became very depressed when I read it, but I'd be happy to give it.
Stay where you're at.
And then, in fact, before I get to your question, the task force report was on judicial compensation was done by an independent third party, correct?
Yes.
And have we all seen those? I can't remember if you brought one to my office or not.
Chair Shields, I could respond to that. I sent a personal copy to every legislator in the building. Delivered many of them personally in private meetings, and I believe it's tab 5.
Excellent.
And it also, to complete the record on that, the Task Force on Judicial Excellence was a group of business, commercial lawyers, and corporate counsel people for some of the major companies in Oregon, that and they did all the work on that.
So, was I incorrect to think that you had hired an independent auditing firm or something
like that? You're incorrect. If I say that respectfully, we do have another report that compares the 13 Western states and compares all compensation and benefits so that you're comparing apples to apples. And the answer to that is that out of the 13 Western states, even when you take into account all benefits, retirement, vesting, all of that, in the 13 Western states, Oregon is 12th. Is that material in your name? Okay, I guess Ms. Lamont has that material.
Could we get a copy of that distributed to the committee? That would be helpful for you. Thank you. Senator Winters.
You know, I can recall, and not because I'm chronologically advantaged either, but I can recall when we would proudly talk about how we compared and how what we did in Oregon was far superior to such states as Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. And the southern states. And
that?
if I look at what's here and how we compare and rank, we can't strut like peacocks anymore. It's really rather, I just commented to Senator Wesley, very, very sad to say that Oregon is at the bottom of the heap. Not alone to talk about the western states, but if we look at ourselves nationally. And so when you look at how you're going to recruit lawyers to replace those who are retiring, from the bench. You have a huge task in front of you.
Senator Winters, I don't know if that was in law school, they used to refer to that as rhetorical or Socratic. But if
here we refer to we refer to it as a softball.
Which I think I'll go with that.
If you would like to,
I would just like to have you repeat it.
Good points, very well taken. Any other questions, Representative Hammer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions. For Ms. Lamont, on page 87, the $3.9 million, that's the implement step. It says implement salary increase in step one, $3.9. Help me understand what that exactly is. I don't quite understand how that fits into the salary adjustment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that the original request was for $10.6 million, which had a two-step process for phasing in the salary adjustment. I believe one on July 1 of 07 and another on July 1 of 08. And what the department is now proposing is to have the entire adjustment occur on July 1 of 07, so that costs an additional $3.9 million.
Thank you. And a follow-up?
Hello.
On page 88, and Ms. Click or Ms. Gates, the current salary listed in that graph is $95,800, as it indicates by the arrow. The current salary as listed in the salary ranking under tab 5 is $105,199.
So if I may, Representative,
please. Gass,
that's the Supreme Court. 95.8 is the trial court number. In the legislature's infinite wisdom, they decided to pay appellate judges more than they pay trial judges. If you look in the rightmost column, you'll see that.
So, Mr. Chief Justice, you get a whopping $7,000 extra for running the entire court system, is that correct?
That's correct, and I also get Representative Shields, and I also get the notoriety of being the worst-paid Chief Justice in the country.
We noted that on the
job. Well, we can't divvy up your pay. Right? That's the problem. Okay.
Take ours.
I'll exclude that debate.
I think I'll use the discretion of the chair and make sure that we get moving so that Judge Block and others who may have come a distance have a chance. Was there anything else you would like to present on the compensation? Great, thank you very much. Up next, program improvements. Judge Eric Block from Multnomah County, and Ms. McKenzie and Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Chair Shields. We're now going to walk through the rest of the policy option packages, starting on page 90. And we're going to start with the Drug and Family Court Support Package. And I will let the judge and Leola McKenzie tell you more about the package.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, there is some written testimony that's been distributed to your desk.
For the record, my name is Leola McKenzie. I'm the Acting Director of Court Programs and Services Division. Package 104 is the Drug and Family Court Support Package, and this package basically extends the grant-funded positions that we have within the Judicial Department where those grant funds are expiring and makes those permanent positions and allows for increased positions for treatment court coordinators, drug court coordinators, and other coordinators within the Judicial Department for next biennium. And Judge Block has a lot of experience in this area, so I'll turn it to him.
Welcome to the committee, Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Shields and members of the committee. It's my privilege to be here to talk to you a bit about the work that we are doing up in Multnomah County in my particular treatment court, and also work that's being done across the state in treatment courts in order to promote the safety of our communities by helping the offenders, be it a drug offender, DUII offender, someone who has committed a criminal act because of a mental health disorder, helping these folks not reoffend by putting them in touch with the means that they need in order to get well. Let me just sort of express at the outset a bias that I have, and that is, one, I am an absolute 100% firm believer in the power of treatment courts to successfully deliver people out the other end, happier, healthier, productive, constructive, good neighbors, good friends, good family members, whereas they come into our courts in various states of life disarray. I would like to see long term there exist in every judicial district in our state three treatment courts: a drug court for the drug offender, a DUII court for the DUII offender, and a mental health court for the individual who has come into contact with the criminal justice system because of a mental health disorder. And the interesting thing about advocating for that type of an approach, the sort of the three-pronged approach, is the population that these courts will be serving is in many instances overlapping. For example, I have people in my high-risk DUII court who, when they come into the court, they do an intensive intake interview, and they admit at that intake interview that they are poly-substance abusers. 97% of the people in my DUII court admit to poly-substance abuse, and in many instances they have the convictions: possession of a controlled substance, delivery of a controlled substance, manufacture of a controlled substance in their past that bears that out. Our court was studied about 2 years ago for a period of 2 years by the federal government, and one of the findings of the federal government study was that a mere 80% of the female participants in my DUII court and 65% of the male participants had diagnosable mental health disorders, be it bipolar disorder, be it paranoid schizophrenia, be it significant personality disorders. So it's, in many instances, a unitary population that we are attempting to serve. And one of the frustrations that I have is that individuals who need our help have to commit the right crime, if you will. So they may have a DUII or they may have an alcohol problem, but until and unless they commit the right crime, my particular court is not available to them. And in some counties, we're lucky enough in Multnomah County to have a DUII court and a drug court. We don't, as of yet, have a mental health court. But if you're in a county that only has a drug court and you commit DUII, but you have a significant long-term alcohol problem, you cannot benefit from a treatment court because, as I say, you have not yet committed the right crime. So we have to sit around as a community and as a public waiting for that person to commit the right crime and hoping that in the interim they don't kill themselves or somebody else. So I would like to see treatment courts available in every judicial district. The policy option package around the treatment court coordinators, I think, moves us strongly in that direction. It would step in and continue 19 positions, as I understand it, some of which are state-funded, many of which are federal-funded. In fact, we've got two positions in my court that we're currently on a federal startup grant that will go away, and we would be beneficiaries of state funding there to continue those positions in my court. And then, of course, the court coordinator policy package would initiate those positions in other judicial districts where there are no treatment courts available. I'm happy to say that, at least from my prior experience in talking to the interim Joint Judiciary Committee, I found myself largely preaching to the choir on the issue of treatment courts, that the legislature has embraced the notion that treatment courts are important and treatment courts work. And the studies do bear that out. In our particular DUII program, and we're this is a high-risk program, we do have people in our program, and it's open to people who have one DUII, which doesn't necessarily mean they don't have a significant drug and alcohol problem. We have people who come in with one DUII who we find, this one gentleman I'm thinking of in particular, who admitted during the course of his participation that he was drinking a fifth of vodka a day. He was just better at avoiding detection, but ultimately got caught and decided to come into the program. So it is available to folks who are who have a small, lesser number of DUIIs. We have people in our program who have 13, 14, 15 DUII convictions spread out over a lifetime. Treatment courts do help people get well. And I brought with me today and handed out just two examples. And, you know, every judge who has the privilege of supervising a treatment court in this state, I'm sure, has a stack of similar type of letters. But I brought these two from my file, one of which, the November 22nd, 2006 letter I actually have sitting on my desk because I find it that inspirational. This was a woman who came into court. She was in her early 30s. She had four DUII convictions in 12 years. At the time of the arrest that brought her into the court, she blew a .36, which is more than four times the legal limit. When the DA pointed that out to me at the sentencing, she turned and without any rancor in her voice simply pointed out that she had blown higher on breath tests than .36. She had recently been convicted for a crime of child endangerment because she was holding her dependent child. I believe the child was about 2 years old at the time, holding the child while intoxicated and fell down a flight of stairs. She told me that story and broke into tears. She badly needed and wanted our help. As you can see in the letter, I think she does a very good job of accepting responsibility, describing the way she was when she started the program. After a little bit more than a year now in the program, she has gotten a job. She's an executive assistant with a major Oregon corporation. She's happy. She's healthy. She goes to treatment. She goes to 12-step meetings at least four times a week. And she is somebody who anyone would be pleased to have as a friend or a neighbor.
Question about that.
Absolutely.
It sounds like you're trying to get the high-risk offenders into the court. Am I hearing you correctly?
We exist principally to get those high-risk offenders in because those are the folks that are doing the major harm. Yes.
Right. And I just wanted to kind of dovetail that with Dr. Latessa's presentation that says we get the best bang for the buck by targeting services to those highest at risk as opposed to those who might be self-correcting anyway.
Right. Yeah, and I think I think when it comes to DUII, generally it's in the vast majority of individuals a self-correcting problem. Most people never get a DUII. Then there's folks that go on and get one. And it's a horrible mistake. They're imperfect people, as we all are, and they didn't realize their state of intoxication, and there we have the option of a diversion program. When you get beyond that first instance, so you've moved from the majority who never get one to the smaller category of people who get one and never go beyond that, and now you're into that category of people who, for some reason, are persisting in this highly dangerous behavior. And what we're trying to do is arrest this behavior in every sense of that word because it's a big red flag. It's a big red flag that these people have, in all likelihood, an addiction or a dependency to alcohol and often other substances, and they're not going to stop until you change the paradigm. This is the paradigm that exists, unfortunately, outside of a treatment court context. And it is, you know, anytime you're arrested for DUI in this state, you're required to go to treatment. But do people actually get there? And is it the right treatment? Is it the treatment that's appropriate for their needs? And there's the paradigm is do the treatment, or if you don't do the treatment, our ability to detect that noncompliance and punish it is not all it should be, in all candor. In a treatment court, what we say is do the treatment and make the changes that are necessary to get well or suffer a consequence. And when you recast that choice to the treatment, the 12-step meetings, the get a job, go back to school, make all the significant changes that are difficult. This is hard work. And if people are faced with hard work and given the flat-out option to either do or not do the hard work, sometimes they're going to choose to not do it. What we do is take away that choice not to do the hard work. They must do the treatment, the 12-step meetings, the getting of the job, the clean and sober living, either in a group home, or we require them not to live with anyone who, unless that person commits not to use or possess alcohol or drugs in the home. So we do everything and anything we can to promote their success and to help them choose wisely. And if they don't, in a treatment court, we have the ability to detect noncompliance and then punish it. We also have the ability to detect compliance and reward it. And yes,
Representative Nathanson, yeah. I had a question for you before you go on to your testimony.
Actually, my question is going to be on the financial aspects of this, the cost and sort of like the ways and means part. So if we needed to finish some more policy discussion, it's okay to wait.
Okay. Why don't you continue?
Let me move then quickly to the essential piece that the court coordinator plays in all of this. A treatment court is a highly collaborative process. You're bringing together entities from a number of different disciplines. You've got the judge, you've got the probation officer, you've got the treatment provider, you've got law enforcement, and everybody has their area of expertise and focus, and all these areas of expertise and focus are essential in order to promote the good outcome. The coordinator literally coordinates among and between these various treatment court participants to assure that information is flowing in and flowing out as needed. The ability of the treatment court to monitor and assess compliance, reward where there is compliance, punish where there isn't, is essential for the reason I stated earlier. You have to eliminate the ability of people not to do the hard work of recovery. And essential to that is detecting it. And essential to detecting it is having a coordinator who in very real time gets the information to the appropriate individual from the appropriate individual. So in my court, for example, the way we enforce the treatment requirement is, one, I order as part of the probation conditions that the individual may not miscancel or reschedule treatment. And I say to them, if you had the disease of cancer, you wouldn't miss treatment. If you had the disease of diabetes, you'd be going to treatment. Same deal here. You have the disease of alcoholism or substance abuse more generally, you must go to treatment. It's a priority, and you may not miscancel or reschedule. Well, if they do miscancel or reschedule, then the treatment provider that we work with know to promptly communicate that to the court coordinator, who promptly communicates it to the court so that the very next day we can have that individual in court to be held accountable for what they did. And guess what? Since we started ordering no miscancel or reschedule, it is a rare thing indeed for me to see anyone missing treatment, and people are benefiting from that. The coordinator is the essential piece of that treatment court paradigm. Yes,
Senator Winters.
You term, you use the term coordinator. It's another term. Do they function like a case manager? Or
well,
are they simply making certain that the person is, does point A and point B and not so much directing them to services?
Well, I think depending upon the size of the court, there'll be some overlap. My court coordinator, really, we have 700 people in our court, so it's one of the largest DUI Act courts in the nation. And so our coordinator has his hands full just coordinating. But in some smaller courts, there'll no doubt be a case management function.
That actually performs other function outside of just the coordination.
Absolutely. Yes. There are other questions on the treatment court piece? There were some.
Yeah, Representative Nicholson, then Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to focus on the cost aspects of this policy option package. The reason I'm interested is I've been talking about drug courts for quite a while now, advocating drug courts, or as we say now, expand it to say treatment courts. Mm-hmm. But I've been talking about drug courts and the effectiveness and wanting to focus on that. What I would like to understand, in the last session, drug courts received some funding. I don't think it was adequate. It seemed more like it was using drug courts as an add-on, or here's a neat experiment, or here's a neat demonstration project, rather than to fund it as just an essential way of the court, the way the courts do business. I would rather a shift to say it's just an essential part of the court operations, but still it seems like it's treated as kind of an add-on thing. Given that there was some funding last session, does the funding here, the $3 million, is this on top of something that's in the EBL and rolled up, or is this replacing money or staff that otherwise just vanishes? So that's part of the question. Does it replace or is it on top of?
Get a response to that one.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson. The positions that we have currently are grant-funded. They will disappear at the end of this biennium. The money was given to the Criminal Justice Commission, who gave it out in grants that we had to apply for. This package makes the positions permanent within our budget and adds some additional positions.
And then the following.
But Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are drug courts that are funded in the essential budget level. This is just relating to those courts, drug courts that were funded through the Criminal Justice Commission grant process.
And Chair Shields, as a follow-up, that Robin Lamont is correct. We do have some positions we have taken out of other places in the courts because we feel they are so important. And what this package also does is make those positions permanently established as drug court positions. So it basically replaces what they've taken and borrowed and begged.
So a follow-up?
Follow-up, yeah.
It would be helpful to me to see a more comprehensive list of this is what we have. Mm-hmm. Some of it was funded this way. Some of it was funded that way. It all goes away or part of it goes away. But rather than seeing sort of a piecemeal analysis, I would like a comprehensive list. It's also been my observation that some, and I've heard more than once, that a lot of drug courts were just started up. It was a bootstrap kind of thing. No funding. There are some counties that just did it. They took it out of their own budgets somehow and reorganized the way they did their work. Do places like that basically lose out, or they're the ones that you're trying to now help support to the same degree that you've been supporting some others?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I can't speak to the counties and what they may have done, but in those courts, that is correct. We are trying to, in effect, make that replace the positions they've borrowed and begged to start up these courts so that they are not being punished for being creative.
Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be a good follow-up in that, as I read this, makes limited duration grant-funded positions. How many of those positions within 104? How many of the limited duration grant-funded positions?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, there are 10.
10 there. And then adds new staff for expansion. How many new staff?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna. There are 19 positions that are either totally new positions or replacing ones that have been borrowed from other court programs.
Follow up there. Those are not part of the 10.
No.
Correct. Okay. Follow up again. In the next paragraph, key component to success, specialty court, is staff. Is that another group of new members?
Chair Shields, Representative Hamm, these are the staff.
That's the 29
that are
talked about above. And then under the performance measure piece, coordinator staff to improve. Is that person or persons part of the 29?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, the coordinator positions are the 29 these are the staff positions that allow us to make the courts to function as efficiently as possible, as the judge talked about, and that will impact the drug court recidivism rate. That's one of our performance measures. That's how this POP supports the performance measure.
Thank you.
And just to clarify that, the $3 million in general fund will completely fund 29 FTD positions. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Shields, that is absolutely correct.
Wish more agencies could do that.
It's
in orders?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I want to follow up on Representative Matheson's request of more definitive list, but also would you provide us when you do that list, and if in the counties what the rollout costs will be? Since you're talking staffing positions for not only 0709, but as we look beyond the budget.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, the positions that you see in the budget request, the $3 million, reflect a phase-in date of September 1 of 07. So it's slightly less than a full biennia, but we can provide you what the 24-month cost is. Absolutely.
I think that would be very helpful. And I just make one comment. It would be very helpful when agencies are presenting their budget if they're as specific and detailed as possible, particularly when we're looking at just broad categories. You're going to be grilled a lot more because we don't have the information that you have in your head, and it helps us in making, particularly as we're talking about priorities, some very sound decisions. So as much as you can be detailed, it would be very helpful.
And Chair Shields, Senator Winters, there is much more detail on these packages in the budget document that I know LFO has copies of, so that a lot of that information is available to you.
And we're running low on time, but I did want to ask Judge Block one quick question. I think you'd probably agree that the drug courts themselves are important, but the treatment and the resources in the community are probably equally important.
It's a hand-in-glove situation. I mean, the whole purpose of the drug court is to coordinate a process by which we, when people through the enforcement and the law enforcement piece are caught violating the criminal laws of our state and there's drugs and alcohol involved, you have to have the treatment piece in place to send them to. And that's what I think is so wonderful about this. It illustrates the fact that truly to be successful, it's not enforcement or treatment, it's both
right.
Working in a coordinated fashion.
So my question is, those of us who are on full ways and means have been hearing about recovery homes and Oxford houses in our neck of the woods. Do you use Oxford houses a lot as a resource?
We absolutely do. Anytime that somebody is in an inappropriate setting, I order them to move into an Oxford house, and typically it's a minimum 6 month stay there.
And I just wanted to mention that because as we look at how we can improve treatment outcomes, say in Grants Pass or in Curry County, we've got to make sure that people have a clean and sober place to live. And there was a policy option package in the human services budget for 3 staff that would develop Oxford housing. And it's pretty incredible. I mean, we have probably, 150 in Multnomah County and probably another 100 in Salem. And they really only have 3 or 4 staff that oversee these. And so that might be something we would think about as a full Ways and Means Committee to figure out how we can make sure that throughout the state people have a chance to live in clean and sober environments.
And if I may, Chair Shields, I agree wholeheartedly. It pains me to see, for example, in our county, there are some funded
beds available for residential treatment. But if you're in residential treatment and you don't come out into a clean and sober, appropriate setting, the risk of relapse goes through the roof. And in that sense, all the money that we've just spent on the residential treatment is, I wouldn't say wasted, but it's a setback.
Similarly with the treatment we do in the Department of Corrections.
Yeah.
Good. Well, let's get rolling so you can get through your portion. You guys can always come back, but I want to make sure that Judge Black has completed his portion.
What I'd like to do is move into Package 107 and go directly to page 93, which has, at the bottom of that page, is the Lane County Child Care Expansion. And one of the things that the judge can speak to very eloquently is the benefit of having a place for children to go in the court when their parents are doing business. So if you could take just a couple minutes to talk about the Portland program, and the Lane County program is very similar.
Absolutely. In Multnomah County, we do have this type of child care facility available in our courthouse. It's called Court Care, and it's a wonderful place. It really is. It happens to exist just across the hall from my current courtroom. And I can't stress enough the importance of having that type of a facility available. I'll just put it this way. There are certain things that children should not have to see and hear. And unfortunately, sometimes people make choices. They bring children with them to court. Sometimes they don't have any choice but to. And for example, in my court, sometimes they'll bring their children, and I have to speak very frankly and directly with them about their use and abuse of drugs and alcohol and other highly inappropriate behaviors. And is he hitting you? What's going on? I mean, we can't mince words. And having children sitting there is simply not appropriate in my view, and I'm sure we all share that. The fact that we have this facility available in our courthouse is enormously helpful to doing the business of the court, be it the parent involved in as a defendant in the criminal justice system, family law situations. Sometimes we have victims that come to court, again, without any options for child care, and they want to, they've come, again, to tell me with their heart what happened to them and how they feel and how it changed their lives. And that's not something that they necessarily want to have known to their children. And so we do have that option available. It's very important. I'm a strong supporter of Court Care, and I really support, again, this facility expanding to Lane County and elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, the cost of that piece of this package is $60,000. It's very insignificant to take it from one half day a week to five half days a week. And I think we have just a couple of minutes left. I'd like to just go back to page 91. This whole package is about ways to improve the way we do business in the courts. The piece I want to talk to you about just for a minute is the piece related to collections, because my collections manager has unfortunately taken another job, and she will be disappearing tomorrow. So if you have any really intense questions, I'd like her here for that. The first part, you'll see under where it says why it is needed. We have requested 18 positions to enhance the collections activities in our courts, and we're looking at how do you do it in innovative ways. You heard this discussed yesterday in the performance measures, some of the new things we're doing. Unfortunately, with the resource constraints we've had recently, the courts haven't had the staff to focus on this, and we want to start to correct that. These are other funded positions that come out of the collections account. About half of the positions are directly planning to go to the courts to improve on, to aid in them. The other half are planning to be used for innovative programs. They may be in courts, they may be centrally. We're going to evaluate that over time. Right now, we have set up what's called a restitution enforcement team that's looking at those people in Jackson and Douglas and Josephine counties with felony and misdemeanor cases that are restitution, and we're doing intensive skip tracing and working with the local partners to help collect what they owe. And so we're running that pilot, and we're evaluating it. And we want to keep moving down this path of how do we collect what's owed better. And so that's a piece of this package that we are requesting. And we'll, the cost of that component is $2 million of other funds. So it's, there is no general fund impact of that. And with that, I think we should probably close for the day as it's 4:30, and we can continue when we tomorrow we'll continue with new judgeships and the technology package, and then we've built in some carryover time into Thursday to finish up.
So I assume the other funds are, it's taken out of the money that you collect?
That's correct.
Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the staffing for the restitution enforcement and the staff for performance measure tracking, that was the $2 million?
No, just the restitution enforcement piece. Well, actually, it's more than just that. It's for all of the collections enhancement. It's 18 positions.
18 positions and $2 million.
Yes. And one of the things I will do before tomorrow is provide you all with a little more breakout of how these pieces fit into the this policy option package. I think that would be useful as we walk through them. So you'll have that tomorrow.
And it's my understanding that $2 million other funds would be money that will not be available then for the criminal fines and assessments. So
that is incorrect.
No? It doesn't. It,
sorry,
isn't it a percentage
that's wrong.
Offset?
I'm wrong.
Isn't it a percentage offset?
Chair Shields, we have a percentage of what we collect that directly goes into that account. It goes there whether or not we use it for this purpose or other purposes. It will not impact the criminal fines and assessment account.
It doesn't affect your the percentage that you're taking out?
We have a limit. It's set already at a certain percentage rate.
Okay.
And this is...
My apologies.
No problem. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, we are running up against the clock. Did you want one final comment? Are we ready to adjourn?
We're happy to be done.
Can I ask a quick question, please? The $60,000 that was the child care piece as general fund?
Mm-hmm. Chair Shield, Representative Hannah, that is correct.
Yeah. Other questions? Good. This meeting is adjourned.